Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and host of All Access Radio. I've spent over 20 years creating innovative alliances in the music industry and driving the convergence of music, entertainment, and technology among media companies, tech companies, and established artists and celebrities. Tonight's guest is my longtime friend and colleague, Jim Griffin. Jim is the managing director of One House, LLC, which is dedicated to the future of music and entertainment delivery. He also works as a consultant to absorb uncertainty about the digital delivery of art and speaks at a variety of global events on the future of digital content. He's been called one of the sharpest minds in digital music by CNN Money and is an entertainment technology visionary, so says the LA Times, and I can corroborate both of them. I'm thrilled to have him with us this evening. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. This is it's really an honor to be on here with you because we've been together through a lot of these wars, and so it's often difficult to go back and explain something to someone who wasn't there. But with you, you were there seeing it right when I was.
Yeah, we hail from the same sandbox circa, 15, 18 years ago in this space. And in fact, I think we first met when I was running music at Apple, and you were still at Geffen and doing one of the earliest streams of an Aerosmith tune. I think that's where it all started.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, that's where it started. That's certainly true. That was my first job in the music business, and that's where I got my start. You know, I was thinking more about networks then than I was about the Internet, but there they came right to our doorstep, and it was a grand opportunity to get involved and make things happen because Geffen is a place that is very empowering.
Yeah, it was then, for sure.
Sure.
So let's just jump right in and start with Faux, because I think Faux is a great example of how you create collaboration, you yourself, in very cool and unique community-oriented ways. Would you share with our listeners how Faux got started, why it's named after a bowl of soup, and how the Faux gatherings fueled some of the leading-edge developments in digital delivery over the past decade?
Sure. It's one of my favorite topics, and it's easily one of the best things I ever did. But I have to say the I is really a we in the sense that it was John Paris and I working together on this in Los Angeles. And I distinctly recall that John and I were sitting down over a meal, and we were thinking about how we could find some way to bring these young people who seemed to know nothing about the music business, of course, and were focused purely on the technology. How could we get, say, that 14-year-old in touch with, say, that 41-year-old, and have them meet each other and understand the things that that were keeping them apart or bringing them together in this world? I guess I could say, like, specifically, we knew Angelo Satira, this teenager from New York, who was otherwise seen as something of a disintermediator or even a pirate.
Our favorite kind of people.
Right. And yet we thought, well, how do we get him together with Dean Kay, who's on the board of ASCAP and the NMPA? How do we get them to understand one another and to realize where each other is coming from? And we realized that Hollywood had a very intimidating velvet rope, that red carpet keeps a lot of people away. And John at the time was working for Michael Ovitz, and I was working for David Geffen. And so we thought, okay, we're the ideal guys to start poking holes through that facade that keeps these people apart.
Yep.
And so at that time, I had said to my assistant, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are trying to reach me, and we're going to have trouble getting back to all of them with everything that's happening. But why don't you just tell them if it's important to come meet me for soup on Sunday at a pho kitchen, and at this particular pho kitchen in Los Angeles, pho 78. Our thought was, you know, just come on down and I'll buy you lunch. And John had the bright idea. He was the first person who attended it with me, and we were building it up. And he said, and let's make a listserv out of it. Well, both the brunches and the listserv have grown tremendously over the years, and it's now thousands of people who have enjoyed them both. And there are spontaneous pho brunches that occur around industry events and on various weekends in different cities. And the list itself has had quite an interesting cast of characters over.
Hasn't it ever? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, they're all people who have made quite a big difference in this digital media space. You know, from Mark Cuban to Michael Robertson to Hillary Rosen, and you know, yourself, and watching many people interact has been a joy for me to watch. And I would say that. Pho is metaphor for the issue at large, and I'll tell you why. For one thing, a pho kitchen is different than a regular restaurant because, properly done, they never bring you a check. The idea is it's a big table, and you can sit there for hours, and
yep.
In Vietnam, families go. And so it's more of a community space than a traditional restaurant where you have to turn a table.
Right.
And every bowl of pho is different because it's cooked on the way to the table, and the things you add and the way you add them make them in some ways somewhat different. You know, you really couldn't. And we have this saying about the meetings that Abraham Lincoln had. You know, Lincoln said that if any two people here think the same way about something, we don't need one of you. So, you know, at the pho table, every bowl of pho is different, and every pho-ster has a different opinion. And certainly that comes out online as well.
Yeah.
I think the real point for me is that I've been paying for all of this out of my pocketbook for now 12, 13 years.
Yeah.
And yet it's not an expense I've ever even felt. It's brought in a great deal more. And so it stood as an example to me of making an investment in your career and in the community around you and bringing people together, how valuable that can be. Because it has long since paid for itself.
Yes, I couldn't agree more.
Right, but it costs
more.
Nothing to join. Anybody who wants to, you find my page at onehouse.com. The instructions are there. You just write me an email, and we're happy to have you as long as you're interested in pho, the group, and not pho, the soup, because we often have to explain to people, though we are named after the soup, and there are some things about the soup that inspire us, this list is not about the soup.
Yeah, all of us have been in the soup of the digital transition. There's many analogies we could go down the road with.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure a lot of people predicted that it wouldn't take this long and that we would still have all of these issues in front of us, and yet clearly we do. It's not.
Well, look at things like, you know, I mean, we could go on about this into a deep tangent, but, you know, from my work with Todd Rundgren on Patronet and an Artist 360 initiatives 15 years ago, we had the vision it took that long for artists to catch that they were the brand and could go direct to their fans. And for you, of course, the whole notion of Tarzan economics, and you've been talking about that for at least a decade. And,
yeah, well, it's an analogy, I think, you know, that you cling to this vine that keeps you off the jungle floor, which is music,
right.
The product, you know, music on a disc, music that moves on the back of a truck from a warehouse to a store, et cetera. You cling to that because it's what keeps you off the jungle floor, but you clearly want to reach for that next vine, especially in this case.
Right.
You know, where there, it ideally it propels you forward, and yet it's very difficult to let go of the old vine and do so. So it's been a
and
kind
so I've
of
always loved that notion. It's synonymous with you, this notion of Tarzan economics. And in fact, it leads me into my next question for you, Jim, which is that we do seem to be caught in a tug of war between those who believe copyright law is antiquated and roadblocks access to content, and those who see it as the last protector of artists' rights and intellectual control. I mean, would you contribute your thoughts on how digital and open access are affecting copyright laws? And ultimately, is it simply time to abandon the old model entirely and create something new?
Look, I don't know anyone who defends the law the way it is in its application. I mean, again, everybody thinks there needs to be change in various ways. I think just to be clear about it, there are those who absolutely see music as property, as chattel and so forth, and want to see it defended as such. And I would put myself in a camp that respects their need to be paid for there to be compensation in order to incentivize creative work.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really clear that, to me, it's become voluntary to pay for music, and that's a source of concern. And I say that not just over music. I would say about any ideas, you know, that if you have a society or an economy where it's purely voluntary to pay for that stuff you hold dear, and that I would say as ideas and art and culture and our expressions of history and so forth, you know, the idea that those are purely voluntary to pay for and they are the most important stuff in society, I would say that's a source of concern, because I think we all know that on some fundamental level we get what we pay for. And if that's the stuff we hold dearest and we make it voluntary to pay, if it's merely a choice or a tip jar we leave for its economy, then we have trouble. And I would say that a civilized society cannot long survive purely voluntary payment for art or ideas or innovation or culture. But at the same time, I think the dilemma is that neither can we take those things I just described and condition access to them on the size of your wallet, or worse still, your parents' wallet.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the idea that a child, that there should be, and again, age appropriate, of course, that they should be denied access to a book or to hearing a song or watching a movie, that's abhorrent to us, right? I mean, it's why we built libraries. You know, we believe in equalizing access to knowledge and art and culture. And so the question for me has always come down to, how do you balance these two things, this notion that you get what you pay for and this is the stuff of life and that we need to incentivize its creation, and on the other hand, it's for the public. We want people to be enriched. We want them to have access to this innovation. And so for me, that balance has always been found in compensation and not control.
Yep.
That these two concepts move in opposition to one another, and that it's very important that there be compensation. And I think that we've oversold the notion of control. Now, I do understand why those who see their stuff as property, or that's what they say, think that at the basic, the basis of that is a kind of control and that that needs to be there. I understand why they feel that way. That is the old vine to which they cling, and it's an important thing to understand. But I think it's all about absorbing their uncertainty about moving forward to that next vine, because in our history, this is clearly what we do, is we move from product to service.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because you needn't go back much further than when electricity arrived. You know, that was when it really changed. Before electricity, I guess we could call that, you know, a time of acoustic.
Yeah.
And you controlled your art with your feet, frankly. You know, if you weren't in the room, they couldn't see you or hear you.
Mm-hmm.
But electricity arrived, and we moved from acoustic to what I'll call electric.
Mm-hmm.
And in that age, we got first loudspeakers, and they grew the audience larger than you could count. And then we got radio, and you could carry audio thousands of miles. And then we got television, and this all happened within a decade of the 1920s. We proved out color TV in 1928 by sending a color signal from New York to London. And so in this very short time period of the 1920s, we went from acoustic to electric, and to having complete control with our feet, to having absolutely no control and watching these things move in a way that I submit to you is indistinguishable from magic. You know, to have been alive in the 1920s.
Oh, yeah.
And there are still some people alive in the world today who were alive in the 1920s. And they got to watch an extraordinary time, right? One that's actually far more interesting than the one we live in. You know, we think, oh, we're so special. We live in this digital time. You know, maybe 5,000 to 10,000 days of dot-com fever. And we think, wow, have we undergone some change? But if you go back to what happened when acoustic became electric, that was indistinguishable from magic. And I would say to you that electric becoming digital has merely been a gradation of change. And so if you look backwards and you say, what happened when acoustic became electric? The answer is that loudspeaker systems, radio broadcast, television broadcast, cable, satellite, now webcasting in the last 10 years, all are covered by a blanket pool-based license that gives up control in exchange for compensation.
Right.
And so really we have this historic string of occurrences that add up to, I think we have a good sense of what's going to happen with sound recordings over the coming decades, because they are subject now to the same forces that molded the compensation systems for these other disintermediaries.
No doubt about it. And by the way, that does lead me to my next question, Jim, which is what do you think the future of distribution is going to look like in, say, 5 years, and how much of an impact do you think on-demand digital distribution will have on the world of traditional media?
Well, you know, for me, I'm focused on actually something looking backwards, because I respect your question a great deal, and I'm actually going to address it, but I'm going to do it by turning backwards.
Fine.
Yeah. Because for me, I've spent a lot of time looking forwards and saying, here's what's going to happen, or here's what I think is going to happen, and my record's been pretty good. But what really shocked me recently was that we actually don't have any good registries of who made this music or who owns it. In other words, we keep track of some of the top stuff, and we have some records out there, but you're not required to register a copyright, and certainly a lot of the information surrounding our copyrights is not registered at all.
Right.
And so whatever our future is, it's going to require that we enumerate those rights that we wish to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, this has been a revelation, because I think it's a fundamental that we move past so quickly, and then we forget that we don't have this, that we haven't enumerated the claims of creators properly.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what we did was the opposite. We passed, I think it was the Berne Convention, the notion that there should be no formalities in copyright.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did away with any requirement that a copyright be registered or that a claim be somehow laid out. And especially in a country in the United States where there are statutory damages at the level of $150,000 for a movement of a song.
That's right.
I think you end up in a very peculiar situation where you ask entrepreneurs to respect the rights of those who actually have not enumerated their rights, not on the public record, not properly in a private context. And so I'm actually looking backwards and saying, how do we cover that thing? How do we get that fixed?
Right.
Because we need that fixed. And by the way, it doesn't matter what you think about copyright to believe what I just said, because let's say you're a strict copyright conservative and you believe that there should be signed paperwork for every use of a particular sound recording or work.
Right.
Or let's say you're, say, a moderate who believes in, say, a kind of blanket private license. Or let's say you're a more liberal person, say, who believes in compulsories over copyright. All three need the registry. You need a registry to find the person to ask permission. You need a registry in order to ensure that the blanket pays out properly. You need a registry to be sure that the compulsory gets its money to the people that it's intended to pay. And we've got examples of all three of these. We've got Sound Exchange, which is a compulsory, which
sure.
is a wonderful organization and gets a lot of artists paid and a lot of entrepreneurs in business, but doesn't have a registry of where to send these checks. And,
mm-hmm.
and it has an obligation to send those checks to people it's never met, who are not its members, who may live in other countries, and it needs a registry in order to pay properly. Clearly, the system of clearing songs that requires written permission, it needs a registry badly.
Mm-hmm.
It is very difficult to find those you need permission from. And so all across the range of perspectives on copyright, there's this fundamental notion of registering and enumerating all of the various works and sound recordings. Certainly Google has gotten at this question as regards books, and they're starting to look at it as regards music and video and so forth. But this is a fundamental that we can't move past as we try to move to the future. And I say that because whatever we think of copyright and whatever business models we'll attain, at the core of it will be knowing who made this work. Who wrote it? Who recorded this thing? Who was the bass player? Who were the background singers?
Well, you know, Jim, I don't know if you know my colleague Peter Rafelson of Rafelson Media, but he is attempting in his own way to handle this very gargantuan challenge with a new venture called Digiramp, which he'll launch very soon.
You know,
and
I
it wants to be that repository, that dashboard for everything you just described.
Now, ultimately, it'll have to involve the United Nations. And I say this with great respect to all present efforts, but there are over 180 countries in the world, and they do have different languages and different character
mm-hmm.
sets. And if we are to do this properly, it will be a truly global effort.
Yep.
You know, and so I'm working with the United Nations to get this done. I think that Francis Gurry and Trevor Clark at WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, are really first-rate people, and they want to solve this problem. They've got experience at it, running the patent database and the trademark database.
Right.
And they want to make this happen for music and for other creative works. And that's where I think it's important for me to point out that another element of whatever's going to happen in the future is definitely going to involve both a more expansive view of what copyrighted works we're thinking about when we think about business models, and also about the role of colleges. I say that because whatever solution one thinks there is to the current dilemmas they face, it's definitely coming out of the colleges. The
mm-hmm.
net itself came out of the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Napster came out of the colleges. Facebook
right.
came out of the colleges. You know, I'll be shocked if whatever is the next important development that we speak of as the future isn't born of colleges. And
agreed.
That's where I would point out that in colleges, there's a silent revolution going on now that was actually born out of the music business. And it's around scholarly publishing. And its origins in the music business are that there were these three students who, in Europe, who were listening to a lecture by Stefan Glanzer, who started Last FM. And they're all superb people. And they thought to themselves, as they were having a conversation, why don't we do what the world has done for MP3 files and apply it to PDF files?
Mm-hmm.
And so they formed a company called Mendeley that engages in the social aspects of scholarly research, making it easier to find research and easier to share research and so forth. And so my point is this, is that a sane copyright policy that addresses the issues that confront, say, Courtney Love or Axl Rose are very, very different than those issues that confront, say, a scholarly researcher at Harvard who's working on a cure for cancer or who might be addressing other important advances for mankind.
You bet.
And that it's essential that we not or that we ignore these distinctions as we move forward, because if we write laws that are one size fits all for sharing things and sharing ideas, what we end up doing is causing enormous trouble for efforts that advance sharing amongst researchers.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's not a slam dunk either. I mean, certainly Pfizer, Novartis, the drug companies, others who own intellectual property, they have concerns about it being shared.
Right.
I understand that, and it's important that copyright apply to them too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pointing out that Hollywood is not the end of discussion on the conundrums that face a sustainable economy of ideas.
Right.
And that my dedication is to a truly sustainable economy of ideas, one that addresses the very difficult problems that are faced, yes, by music and by movies, and yes, by books, but also by scholarly research, and those who are really accelerating the pace of addressing the problems that face mankind.
Agreed. And so, you know, you mentioned earlier that you are, in fact, working for the UN and WIPO on the International Music Registry with our talented mutual colleague Nick Garnett, among many others.
Right.
But could you tell us a little more about that project, Jim, at a little bit of a deeper level, and how it will affect the music industry and audiences?
Sure. It's been misunderstood to some degree, and I say that because this work has its origins in a project called the GRD Project out of Europe. The EU, together with eight prominent stakeholders, that being Apple, Amazon, and Nokia, and Universal Publishing and EMI Publishing, and PRS for Music in England, and STIM in Sweden, and SACEM in France, these eight stakeholders sought to address the problem of building a music registry by calling for proposals to build a global repertoire database. Now, their work was mostly focused on publishing, because publishing has the biggest problem. And I'm not blaming publishers for this. It's simply the nature
right.
of it is that you could have more than 30 songwriters for a song. And then if you add that in to the numerous countries in Europe, you have a real need to solve the problem as regards publishers in Europe. And so that's why this all these efforts stem from where the worst problem exists, and that is with publishing in Europe.
Right.
But if you look more broadly at how one builds a truly global repertoire database, it can't be done by publishers in Europe, of course.
Right.
It has to involve, for example, countries that have different character sets and different languages that are found in Europe. I mean, if you don't include the Chinese, for example, you're definitely not building a global repertoire database. And yet, to do so, you must be engaged in active translation and using different character sets. These are practices that the United Nations in general and WIPO specifically follow to the T. And
right.
So it's important that that effort that got started in Europe with publishers for what is clearly a bigger problem. I mean, imagine as an American that there was a different registry in every one of the 50 states and a different rights situation in every one of the 50 states, and that you had to get a clearance in Illinois and then in Indiana and in Ohio. You know, you would say, my goodness, you know, that calls for even more for a registry. And,
right.
And in the United States, we need one. I mean, you can't find even 40% of the rights holders in the U.S.
Yeah.
So then if you go to Europe, where you've got this divided rights circumstance, clearly the problem's even bigger. And then if you look at truly global distribution and delivery, which is what you're doing with the Internet, right? Because whenever you put something out, it could end up anywhere.
So now it's an exponential challenge.
Exactly right. And so that's my point, is that this snowballs from what is a easy-to-understand problem that would arise amongst publishers in Europe specifically that calls for a truly global solution. And so the IMR looks as a registry of registries at the GRD and Fast Track and ICE and these different efforts around the world to build collaborations among societies and registries, and then looks to coordinate them and synchronize them into an international music registry, much as does WIPO's patent database make it possible to register a patent with it, and then you are automatically registering in all of the different jurisdictions that you seek. And at the same time, you can search all of those patent registries in all of those jurisdictions
Brilliant.
In which you're applying. And the same thing is true with trademarks, again, thanks to WIPO. And so the notion is to do that for music, because I found that this is a predicate to any real progress in the area of copyright or business models. And this has to happen not only in the United States, but in a truly global sense.
I mean, yeah, you bet.
Consider, if you will, Pandora, which is enabled by the U.S. Webcasting compulsory, to be sure. But it's only available in one country, and that's the United States. It's not that they don't wish to do business abroad. They do. They've spent a great deal of money pursuing licensing in other countries.
You bet, but the rights are too challenging.
And just the right circumstance. And so registries lead to the kind of licensing that's essential. And I'll be clear about what that is. What the music business needs is to make it faster, easier, and simpler to pay for music.
Correct.
In hopes that when it is, more people will.
Such that we don't keep losing opportunities.
You've got it. And so I see a registry as the first predicate to making it faster, easier, and simpler to pay.
Yeah.
Because when it is faster, easier, and simpler to pay, more people will pay.
I couldn't agree more. And again, I think that segues into it's something I want to touch on next, which is that we know that the amount of music being downloaded and listened to is more than ever before. But sales are pretty much in a steady tailspin. And, you know, Warner Music alone has lost over $10 billion just over the past decade. What do you think has to happen to make the rising consumption of music translate into revenue?
Well, I would rephrase it. I would say that mind share and market share are at odds with one another.
Well, okay.
I would not use the word consumption, because I have to say that while it may seem like nitpicking, it's been a bugaboo of mine for a while. And that is that we really don't consume music anymore, not in the sense we used to. And by that, what I mean to say is not that we don't use music, but we don't consume it, meaning we don't decrement supply. And we don't control supply versus demand. this is it. That is, those are words that apply to the old vine, to a product economy. You know, we don't live in a world where, you know, like the one you and I grew up in, where if I bought a phono record off the shelf, it was one less phono record that you could buy. And there was a company controlling the supply in the background, matching supply to demand to maintain a particular price.
That's right.
You know, much of what we've been grasping at in vain over the past decade or two is maintaining that in a digital world, and that is unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
That does not work. That, you know, we are moving from an economy based on friction to one that is truly friction-free. And so, you know, even using words like consumption, which I have to recoil against, cause angst for me because it reinforces a bad kind of thinking, a thinking that really won't help us as we move forward.
Fair enough.
You see what I mean?
Point
and
taken.
So,
yeah.
For me, it's so important to let go of the box, of the product, of control,
right,
of consummating relationships with consumers ad seriatim without so much as finding out their name and thinking that is good business. You know, that Christmas, when people walk to the counter with a $20 bill and consummate that transaction and move on without getting their name, that that's good business. That is, in fact, a very male way of working in business, is to consummate relationships ad seriatim without so much as finding out their names.
I couldn't agree more.
To consummate
is
we all know the root of that word, right? What we
yep.
mean when we say consummate.
Yep.
And what I'm thinking that we're looking at is truly a feminization of marketing. What we're experiencing, and I think for the best, is that women get that true value comes from starting a relationship that never ends, not consummating it immediately and moving on. And I think if you look carefully, Amazon.com is a woman, right? Because it remembers your birthday. It knows
yes.
your sizes. It,
yes.
then, you know, it knows a lot about you, and it keeps it in a file of facts. And this typically is behavior I associate with women in my life.
Yes.
And I know that men, you know, we tend to forget very quickly and we want to consummate and move on. So I'm saying that I think we're undergoing a feminization of marketing, and I think that is a very good thing. And I think it is so much less about consummation. It is so much less about consumer, and it is so much more about starting this relationship. And I think
that really is where value lies. I totally agree with you, and I love, yet again, you're just a master of these high-concept analogies, because I think, just like Tarzan Economics, I think that notion is so right on, and I don't think I've ever heard anybody articulate it in just that way.
Well, it is a fundamental thing, isn't it? The difference
it is,
between
of course.
Us. And, yep. and what I'm yep. saying is I think that, you know, we need to see more of it at conferences and so forth, too. You know, we need to see more women on panels, more women in the industry. It coincides with a shift. I mean, it should happen purely for equality, of course, and I'm not suggesting otherwise, but I am pointing out that that change coincides with a skill set shift that is very important for where we're headed. And that
well, you know, I obviously, as a woman, and someone who has worked in two male-dominated industries throughout my whole career, music and technology, I'm often the only woman or one of the only women in some of these things, and so I can appreciate the analogy very, very directly.
Yes, and those successful artists now, I think, are those who do start relationships with their audience.
Agreed.
And they keep them going over a long period of time, and I don't view that as bad. I view this as a good thing, and I think it's growing. And so I guess my observation back to you would be that while the product may be shrinking, the service of music is actually growing. And so while
That's
we
right.
watch the product recede, it's not like music is less relevant.
No.
It's not like these are buggy whips. Our mind share is higher than it's ever been, and we're seeing that value gleaned in music the service. I mean, ASCAP, BMI, CSAC in the United States, their Sound Exchange, all of them, their revenues represent a different economy in music, not
yeah.
around music the product. None of them handles music the product.
By the way, I see music the product as just one spoke on the artist 360 wheel. So,
sure, although for many it is the only spoke, right? In other words, radio got used to saying, well, music should be free because we help you sell those products.
Right.
You know,
right.
we shouldn't pay for it.
Right.
You know, and any of a number of people justify balancing their own books on the back of musicians on the grounds that, hey, they can sell those shiny little discs.
Right.
You know, and I'm merely pointing out that, you know, I'm not sad for a day that music the product recedes if it's music the service that grows to accommodate it. And I think we have to accept that in order to truly reap the benefits of it. You know, clinging to music, the product, has cost us much goodwill.
And a decade of change.
Yes. But, and I'm not, you know, they have their reasons, but the lawsuits, the clinging to the old vine without moving on, it hasn't won us a lot of fans, and yet there are fans to be won and money to be made, because music to service is bigger than it's ever been.
Well, see, so you and I couldn't agree more, Jim. You and I are agents of change, and we look towards the future. But I must step back for a moment and pull us back into the Wayback Machine a decade ago when the original Napster lost its battle with the labels. And the reason that's so significant even now, is, in my humble opinion, is because, you know, I know that Napster offered the labels $1 billion. $1 billion. It sounds like an Austin Powers thing, but it's true. With their 70 million audience, to stay alive and monetize and prove that that audience could be used to monetize music. And instead they were shuttered. And with that, the labels dug their own grave, in my humble opinion. Had they embraced something like that with 70 million people who voted for that, that's what they wanted, I think the industry, that the record industry that makes shiny discs, would be in a much different position than it's in today.
It would be different, and, you know, respectfully, I guess people could debate that, right? I mean, I look back at it and I say Napster won, without any doubt. I mean, the labels may have won the battle, but they lost the war.
Oh, yeah, 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 for sure.
You know, I think, and they know it, too.
Yeah.
And this really is the point, is that, you know, whenever the industry tries to work together, they have enormous trouble. I mean, this is an industry, frankly, that circles its wagons and shoots in at one another.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, the irony is that we're subject to the kind of government scrutiny for antitrust that is actually not applied to other businesses. And let me give some examples of this, because I think fundamentally the answer to people sharing music is to let the music industry work together in order to make licensing faster, easier, and simpler.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, these are, right, the two things you learned in grade school, that you should share with others, and you should work together.
Right.
But guess what? Sharing with others is ostensibly illegal or infringing activity, and working together is, too, in the form of antitrust laws.
And yet they have no choice based on the survival of what's got to happen here.
But actually there are choices. Let me give you an example. In 1961, John Kennedy signed the Sports Marketing Act of 1961, permitting baseball, basketball, football, and hockey to market themselves collectively without concern for the antitrust laws.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they were given an exemption from antitrust laws
for
the purposes of working together to build their businesses. And I would say that we need nothing less for sound recording companies and publishers and musicians and so forth to work together to accommodate the change that's out there. That's why I think one of the answers to the problems of sharing comes from letting the industry work together to license in ways that they haven't previously been permitted to license.
In other words, to give an exemption on that antitrust layup.
Yes, let me give you another example. The Capra-Volstead Act permits agricultural entities to come together industry-wide. So you see marketing for real Wisconsin cheese or California olives or Texas beef. And so, in each of these two contexts, agriculture and sports, for many of the very same reasons, we permit them to work together to address their problems.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the music industry, we don't. We don't permit that. And in fact, I think that every time we see a choir forming, we write a subpoena up to talk to those people about their licensing practices. I actually think the answer is letting them work together to come up with blanket and collective licenses that make it faster, easier, and simpler to pay so that we can all just pay and move on, much as Amazon gets its one click and done. I mean, you literally could not solve the problem of, say, marketing access to the NBA games or the baseball games unless you could bring the referees together with the players, together with the owners, to create a pool of money with some fair way to split it up.
Oh, yeah.
Which is how football and baseball and basketball and hockey and, in some cases, agriculture are now done.
Right.
You know, the grain silo was the farmer's answer to the big grain company.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the idea that we would collectivize our creative output or our agricultural output in order to maximize its value has been, in fact, our answer ever since electricity came. And only in this area of selling sound recordings have we been reluctant to move forward in that area. And yet, even there, we are making progress. Sound Exchange in the United States takes the rights of sound recording owners and makes it possible to webcast or digitally transmit over Sirius or XM any content.
Sure.
The Beatles, the U2, you know, without having to go license
that
content from the owner. And
right.
the result is lots and lots of money for music. And
correct.
I think
I would argue that based on what you just shared about what should happen with the labels, my hunch is that you're addressing that through your work with the IMR and UN and WIPO.
Look, I just really came to the point where I felt that, you know, you can argue for collective monetization or whatever approach you might have to copyright, but how can we do it while we still do not have a registry of who owns what?
Right.
I mean, if you believe in collective monetization, even if you're against it and you believe in permission, you need a registry.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know who owns what. It's a basic fundamental of respect. And it's respect not only for the entrepreneurs who might cross your path and you think violate your rights, is to enumerate the rights you believe should be respected, but it's also necessary if you wish to get paid down the road for your creative endeavors.
That's right.
And so I will just flat out say, rights unenumerated are rights disrespected.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to come to understand that and work to solve that problem. And we can't rush past having a basic registry as we look to solve problems. And by the way, we don't need to look too much further than our own mortgage mess to realize that part of it is related to the mortgage registry problem and not knowing who owns which mortgages.
Right.
So again, all around us, these basic fundamentals like a registry just cry out to be solved. So that's why my efforts are pointed there right now
and why I
think it's so important.
I completely agree, and I think, as usual, you're right in the center of the hurricane to try to make effect changes as you are throughout your career. You know, you said recently that we work on a tip jar mentality right now, where consumers have the choice to pay or not pay for
right.
their music and other digital content. Jim, do you think there's any chance that educating the consumer on artist rights can affect the economic crisis that content providers are facing?
No, look, I don't think that. You know, that's along with the notion that you could somehow code, you know, with software or congressionalize with laws or condemn with priests and so forth. You know, the three C's for me, you know. And I just don't think that you're going to be able to code or legislate or moralize enough to people over a period of time to achieve the result that we're calling for there. I don't think that's ever going to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it needs to feel downhill to everybody involved. It can't
sure.
feel like you've got to be educated about it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think time immemorial, this is how we've done it, is we've come up with a simple fee, a flat fee that we apply across the spectrum. You know, outside of the United States, this is a very accepted thing. I mean, you know, if you ask anyone in London, well, you know, what about the BBC fee? You know, there might be a few people who say, gee, I wish it wasn't so high, or I wish we didn't have to pay it, but they're not doing away with it anytime soon.
Correct.
You see? And throughout Europe, throughout Asia, you see the same thing. You see pools of money with fair ways to split them up, supporting art throughout the world.
Yeah.
And it's how we solve our thorniest problems everywhere, including the United States. You
mm-hmm.
know, cable TV is just that. You know, that it's a pool of money and a fair way to split it up through negotiations with rights holders.
Yep.
It's how we get at the problem. And so, you know, I think that makes sense, that you do have to pay for it. There needs to be some kind of payment. I do think that payment should be equalized to the degree possible. In
mm-hmm.
other words, that it should be relatively low and spread out across the population, such that we incentivize the creation of culture and we get artists well paid.
Right.
You know, and I think clearly over history, we know we can do this. I mean, the story starts in 1847, by the way.
Yeah.
That's when Bourget, the great composer, goes to dinner on the Champs-Élysées in Paris at the Ambassador's Restaurant, and he hears the orchestra playing his music. And he's stunned by this because they didn't ask him permission and they didn't pay him for it. So he leaves without paying for his meal.
Right.
And they take him to court And the judge says, look, you've got to pay for the food, but they've also got to pay you for the music.
That's right.
Now, the thing was that Henri de Balzac and Victor Hugo were friends of Bourget's, and they had recently had this law passed that said they got paid for people who read their books aloud in public. And they realized that all these rights were illusory unless they worked together to get paid. Because, you know, they didn't exactly fancy the idea that every restaurant would come visit them and ask for permission, you know, and pay them some fee.
Right.
So they formed SACEM in 1847. In France, the first artist rights collecting society. And the idea has spread throughout the world. So now we have these, and many of them in some cases in certain countries, like in the United States, we have four of them at least. And so I simply say that if you look backwards in history, you will understand the future better. But don't turn to me to look for, kind of crystal ball kind of predictions. I try to go back and read microfiche and see what history has to offer. And someone who looks at it that way, I think, would find that what's going to happen in the future of the music industry and other creative industries is really clear. And it's a course that was set on from the arrival of electricity and before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just amazing how well-read and researched you are from looking at a full, well-rounded perspective for all of this stuff. I mean, along the same lines, you said you don't believe it should be voluntary as a society, that we pay for the arts. How do we legislate a different picture than what we currently have? And if you could create Jim Griffin's perfect reality around the consumption, artistic works and how everybody gets paid, I mean, what would that look like from your perspective, Jim?
Well, look, I'm an American, so it wouldn't be legislated.
Yeah.
You know, I say that because
I got to watch words like legislation and consumption around you.
Yeah, well, no, I just say that because I think it's important for the world to, you know, to acknowledge like that as Americans, we typically don't trust our government the same way
right.
that somebody, say, in the UK would, or somebody who has a longer history with a good government or whatever. You know, we're a different breed. And so in America, that's not going to be legislated. But I'm not going to exclude that in some other countries, Scandinavian countries, whatever, that it might not be a product of government action or legislation, to each their own and to all societies, however they should choose. But in my world, I would say that we do this privately, that we negotiate these fees, that we arrive at these contracts, much as we have with HBO and others.
Right.
And that if that can't happen or that proves impractical, that we end up imposing a fee, much as we do, say, with SoundExchange on behalf of webcasters and satellite radio, and that government helps smooth out the edges, that we can negotiate a separate fee if we wish, but in order to make it faster, easier, and simpler to pay, and to have something to plug into the old spreadsheet if you're a business person or someone with an idea trying to innovate, that there is a fee that you can pay in lieu of negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I think works. And demonstrably so. It is what has Pandora in business now. It is what has Sirius and XM in business today.
Right.
You know, no one seriously takes the position that they should be negotiating, say, with Yoko Ono about the price of music from the Lennon estate, and then odd seriatim every other rights holder that they wish to do. Just not practical, right?
No.
Or that Pandora should do that, or for a kid in his garage who wants to compete with Pandora.
Fair enough.
And furthermore, that even if one thought that they should negotiate every one of those deals, then they should surely support a registry that at least lets you know where to find those people.
Absolutely.
So I think that ultimately it does come down to government helping in some small ways. And so here I think that it's appropriate to point out that while, as an American, I don't think it will be legislated, I do think there's room for groups like the United Nations to build lighthouses. And I say that because even if you don't believe strongly in government action, you know, our mutual friend, Kelly Michael Robertson, if he were here on the phone, he would.
And I've had him on this show.
Yeah, and he'd be horrified. You know, he'd say, look, government, I shouldn't be involved at all. And,
right.
and for the most part, I actually do agree with him. But where I do disagree is in areas that are clearly government responsibilities. And I would say things like lighthouses, you know, where it's been proven over time that lighthouses, their economics have such great externalities, benefits beyond those who paid for them, that they should be paid for as broadly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that registries of IP or ideas and the stuff that's so important in life, you know, music, movies, books, scholarly writing, scholarly journals, advances in the STEM area of science, technical, engineering, medical, that these things can't be left to be paid for through a tip jar or through voluntary payment.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, neither do I think they benefit from a stifling kind of level of observation or government control. And so my hope is for the negotiation of licenses that evolve to provide a kind of collective monetization,
mm-hmm.
much as does insurance provide a blanket of protection for society. You know, we acknowledge that automobiles and vehicles do great damage. You know, they kill and maim many people every year, and yet what do we do about it? You know, what we do about it is we create a pool of money and a fair way to split it up through insurance. And we recognize that safety only goes so far and
will not
ultimately protect us. And, you know, with music, we're lucky. When it hits, you feel no pain. You know, Bob Marley said it. I believe it, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, here we're not killing people. We're not maiming people like vehicles are. And yet with vehicles, what do? We leave it to a pool of money. And so,
right.
Again, I would say that we need that same kind of respect for an economy of ideas, one that comes up with some kind of sane, balanced monetization system.
Yeah.
And so that's why I wasn't running away from your question about copyright or legislation. I think everybody admits there needs to be change, but some of the change we need is actually far more fundamental and enabling of business in ways that don't require substitution of judgment by government over rights holders, but actually enable business. Things
yep.
like registries, things like blanket licenses, things that get everybody moving and make it faster, easier, and simpler to have a sustainable economy in ideas, because without that, we have very little future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
We depend on.
Yes, and I agree. I just want to, as we start to come down the home stretch of our time together, I do want to touch on one of your other business ventures for a minute, Jim, and that's Cherry Lane Digital, which you've described as absorbing uncertainty over the transition to the digital delivery of art. Would you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
I'm not doing it anymore. I did it for a number of years. It was some of the best years of my life because I have such respect for Milt Okun, who is just a giant of the music business. And Cherry Lane Digital was our collaboration together, me and Milt.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you know, we did a lot of great business together. We had a lot of great clients together. And it all pales by comparison to just getting to know the man himself.
Yeah.
And my hat is off to him. He has had a fantastic career. He recently sold the company to BMG.
Ah.
And you know, that I think is the culmination of a fantastic career. I happen to know Milt built that business sitting looking out over the Cherry Lane Theater at Commerce and Barrow in the Village in New York, thinking about how he might help his artist friends get better paid. And I know that his first technology was a box of index cards, and that he sat down and thought, okay, why is it so hard to get paid? And what can I do to change that?
Right.
And he did a lot to change that, and part of it was influencing me to want to change it and teaching me the business. And so I think properly expressed, Cherry Lane Digital was me learning the business from Milt Okun.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I carry that forward. What a fantastic man. What an amazing career. His many ventures, which involve opera and the music publishing business and carried over into Pokemon and the World Wrestling Federation.
Wow.
And John Denver's career, of course, depended on Milt Okun. And he was once a part of Harry Belafonte's orchestra. And,
good heavens.
You know, and I just have to say, what an amazing guy. And he's led an amazing life. And he's one of those people that I think of when I think, you know, it's sad that our business honors its young more than it does its old.
Well, but here's my you're walking right into my last question in our time together today, Jim, and that has everything to do with you leaving a legacy, much as Milt has done, What would you say, if you could look ahead, would be your best contribution as part of your legacy, not just for your own family with Stacy and little Hazen, but for all of us as your peers and colleagues in the industry at large?
Look, if I would be so lucky as to live another 30 years like Milt Hogan and do it with grace and class and leave the impact he did, then I will feel like I made a big difference. But
well, I feel like you already have. But
as it is, you know, I think it is just something that is... It is far better to honor one's profession than to be honored by it. And I will simply say that is my goal, is to be of service, because it has been an honor to be of service to art and culture. You know, those who know me know that I can't play a note. You know, I have very little understanding of what makes music good other than what, you know, moves my heart or my head.
Right.
And I just love being of service to artists and to culture. And if that has happened, then I feel fantastic about it. And in order to even think of myself alongside of a Milt Hogan, I will need to spend three more decades actually gracefully making some kind of an impact. And I think that would be a far greater challenge, because I was lucky, really, really lucky over the past couple of decades to have the friends that I have who made it possible for me to do what I do. You know, Tom Zutaut, David Geffen Company, and John Klodner and Gary Gersh, and all the fantastic people there, Bill Bennett, and Luke Wood, and Robert Von Gaben, and the people I got to work with there. You know, truly, it's about being in the right place at the right time, and I was lucky to be in the right place at the right time and to be that person, and then to work with Milt Hogan at Cherry Lane, and to have had the honor of working with Sound Exchange, and actually now working with having worked with Warner Music Group, with Edgar Bronfman and Michael Nash, fantastic stuff, Alex Zubiaga, and
George
White, what an amazing guy.
Yep.
And now to be able to work with Dr. Francis Gurry at WIPO and Trevor Clark, his head of copyright, is just a fantastic thing for me. So I've really been the luckiest guy in the business. And I would say is my legacy, luckiest guy in the business, at the right time.
and we are all very lucky. Those of us that call you friends and colleagues, you certainly have been that to me over the bulk of my time in the digital music space. We both come at it from pretty much day one. And I just cherish our relationship. You're one of the most gracious, well-rounded people I know. And I'm honored to call you my friend. And I thank you for your time with us today.
Well, thanks for all of that, and I'm very appreciative for the hour we spent together.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. We will see you at our next session of All Access Radio. Good night.
Bye-bye.